So, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Boom Chuck, a Drummer's Podcast. I have my friend, my dear, dear friend, Drew Orton with us.
Hey, everybody.
He is the master and king of Grace Notes. And, you know, I enjoy watching him play. I sometimes get jealous watching him play of the things he can do. But you are the drummer for a band called Demons.
Yes.
Right?
Yep. Demons USA.
You are the drummer for Bennett Wales and the Relief.
Yep.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And then are you still doing, I know with obviously with COVID and all this stuff, you still doing the backline stuff and all that? Or is that kind of like on pause right
now? That's completely just fell off a cliff. It sucks. But yeah,
it's crazy.
We took the biggest hit, music production. It was wild. Like literally went from making money to you make $0 now, but you still have like a warehouse filled with millions of dollars worth of gear that just is going to collect dust till however long,
yeah, right?
You know?
The reason I was doing this, because I literally like, man, it was like January, February, whatever, last year. And I was like, I should start a podcast. You know, we had been on a couple and there wasn't really much going on. I was like, I should do that. It'd be fun. And then COVID hit and I just kind of went on the back burner and whatever.
Yeah.
And then this new year, I was like, this isn't going anywhere. I'm not bored, but I'm kind of bored. So I was like, shoot, man, I'm going
to
do this.
Podcasts are great. I mean, I've been listening to them almost every day because, you know, listen. I mean, obviously we both love music, but after a while, you can only listen to so much stuff. Like it's great to have something to take your mind off of it.
I got to hear some voices.
Yeah.
You also, on top of all the bands and do all this, you are the co-host of a podcast called Death by Music. Is this correct?
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. We actually just got...
I did a little bit of research.
You did,
like, you know,
dude.
I'm trying.
Look at you, Mr. Journalist. Yeah, we just started it. Just came out with season one. Pretty much, it's... Obviously, like, there's a big true crime fad and, like, murder podcast thing. We were thinking of how we could, you know, come up with a premise to kind of do music and that, since I know mostly like a lot about music. Me and my girlfriend know a lot about music. And then our friend Cassie's like all about true crime. My girl's also like a criminal justice major. So we were like, how can we collide this? Like, there's a lot of deaths in rock and roll. Let's just bind the two and we'll talk about deaths in music. So we go over all kinds of stuff from like the Great White concert fire where like 100 people died. We talk about
to that
Elvis.
One.
We got a John Bonham one, which is great. I learned out a lot of new stuff about him that I wasn't familiar with, but it's a new idea, but it's working out. It's pretty fun.
That's cool. Yeah. So if you are listening to this, you should listen to that.
Yes.
There's your plug, right?
Yep.
Death by Music podcast.
Death
yes,
by music.
Yes. Here we go. All right. So this whole thing, as you may or may not have, I mean, I talked to you a little bit about it, but man, this is about drums, man. Like, I don't care about, I want to know about the gear you play. I want to know about how you started, not the pots and pans crap that everybody says, like, I started when I was two.
Right.
No. When did you get your first drum set? What was it? What brought you to where you are right now? So this, the stage is yours. And I'll fill in and giggle and just look at you because you're so pretty the whole time. But I want you to just say and share with the world how, and it can be fast, it can be whatever. This is no time limit. But how did you get to where you are right now from the beginning?
That's exciting, man. That's super exciting. I was lucky enough to have a dad that played drums. So my entire life, I've never known a house with a drum set not in it. You know, it's just
awesome.
Always been kind of a part of me. And when I was younger, it was an anger tool. So like a lot of dads or even like drummers were all kind of like particular about our gear. We're like, you know, don't touch my drum set. My dad was just like, he was working. He was like, dude, just go play if you want. It was a midge kit. It was like I don't even know. I think it was, what was it called? It was a no badge. Like it was just blue sparkle.
Really?
Super sick, 60s. Just a Jap made in Japan, just like pretty much a Slingerland ripoff. And he had all the rototoms set up with the square, the 80s style, like square duct tape all over them. So it sounded all mute math and dead.
Oh, yeah.
And yeah, from there, I really just always did it. It wasn't even something where I wanted to be a drummer or I was aspiring to be one. It was it's always just been a part of what I do. It's always just been there for me. So I've been super lucky to have you know, to have that. But eventually I wanted to start taking it more seriously. And I got a few lessons, spent some time in school for it, but like quickly realized that like conservatives like it's not conservatives. It's like a conservatory style learning wasn't really for me when it comes to like sight reading and and I started working at Guitar Center and just like started drum hoarding videos and just practicing my ass off. And yeah, I guess here we are, you know, X amount of bands later in Studio Records. And
I was going to say, and you worked your way up. I also worked at Guitar Center for a little bit. You worked your way up. You were like the drum buyer, right, for a long time?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I worked up to like the corporate. I stopped at the corporate line, you know, but I started as just like an accessories dude and then became drum department manager, then assistant store manager, and, you know, eventually.
All that pressure to be A-level and like all that. Like, I don't know.
Dude, the spiffs. You remember the spiffs? They used to be great.
Oh,
be
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You sell $40,000 worth of gear this month. Like, you get like a MacBook Pro. They used to be really good. Of course, it's gone downhill.
I remember I couldn't take it. I mean, I loved it. I was part of the time frame where like they were like, hey, no more jeans. And everyone has to wear a collared shirt. And it was like, dude, we are not used car salesmen. We are selling guitars and drums and basses and like, really? So
you got in post.
It kind of sucked.
Post golden era.
Yeah,
unfortunately.
Exactly.
You just missed it. I luckily was there for the golden era. And there was like this little hint of time where like Guitar Center was really magical. Yeah. And unfortunately, just it's kind of hurting right now.
It is what it is. I mean, I still go there because, and I still have friends that work there.
Same,
but
same.
You know, you got to get stuff. That's a big box store for us. You know what I mean? I do love the fact that like there's not a lot of stores that'll let you play anymore. I remember rolling in, and there's like 15 guys playing drum sets at the same time, and I'm like, I already have a headache, and
I'm late for my gig. I need to get sticks. I need a snare head, and like I can't find anyone. The salespeople are trying to. It was, you know, who had it? You know who did it right? Was Mars. They did it really correct because they had the counter was like in that soundproof booth.
Yep.
And you know, you could wank all you wanted in the drum lobby and you could actually still hear customers. But I remember some of the most like I am more with my chi now because I worked in the drum department and trying to make a sale or talk to a real customer while someone's just like covering Slipknot, you know. It's pretty intense.
Oh, dude. I ended up going to the. I went in the back and I was like, I'm gonna organize this warehouse and I'm gonna come out and scream at the people that are freaking just playing blast beats. And I was in like Detroit, so like everyone was. It was either a bunch of guys came from after school and they're practicing their gospel chops, or they're playing blast beats. And I'm sitting there like, I can't do the gospel chops. That's awesome. And I can do the blast beats. But I don't want to hear the blast beats right now. And I'm just trying to put stuff away and check stuff in, whatever. But
you ever try
it was years of my life. It was fun. But
you ever try the one stick where they're like, hey, let me get some practice stick? They call them practice sticks. And then you know.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, shit. You try to give them one, you know. And they're like, where's the other one? It's like, don't you
I
need
was
to
just I was like, hey, man, I got to make some phone calls. You can't do
you
it.
Just
or I'd send them in the freaking – the cymbal room had, like, the glass around it. Send them in there.
Yeah.
But
– yeah, put a little jazz kit in there for all the wankers. That was a good trick.
Oh, yeah.
I know. Other than that, like gear-wise,
you have two different sets, right, for the two different bands, right? Are you playing different?
I do. Like with Four Stage, we have over 45 kits. So, and those are accessible to me, which is super spoiling for studio stuff and all.
Yeah, I'm very jealous.
You have to come by someday. But my like personal thing is I just love vintage drums, dude. Like that's especially the last like 6-7 years. Like I really got into like not collecting, but restoring players' kits. I play them all, but like and having like kits for each project is really important for me. Like with Demons, I use the 72 Vistalite, which is just I don't know if you've ever have you ever played that kit. I don't think you ever did.
Not, I mean, not yours personally, but I just recorded in Austin in October, and I ended up using – it was the reissue. It wasn't an original, but I played a Vistalite. And the funny thing, I was like, this isn't going to record well. He's like, just watch. And I played my Yamaha Toms, of course, but like, yeah, he put this kick down and I was like, oh.
They're pretty unreal. Pretty awesome. They're pretty unreal. There's something to the old ones though, especially the really early ones. I think they stopped, they started doing like a 45 degree seam in like 76 or 77, something like that, because the vertical seam was separating. But there's something about the, and now of course they're seamless. They just like put them in a tube and slice it. But there's something special about that, the vertical seam. Like they're super fragile. Definitely have to keep them in the Heemsenbergs, like foam, hard case. But dude, they sound so good. And the bearing edges are not perfect. It's just this, and I think that's what it is about vintage drums, is like they're so thumbprinty, you know, like. Obviously, you have duds and stuff, but they're not. There wasn't a lot of machines involved compared to what there is now with, like, you know, just laser cutting and all that stuff.
Right.
And they have this character to them that's like, it's romantic. And you know that someone else isn't going to have that exact sound.
Well, yeah, the characteristics, the imperfections make the characteristic of that kit, right? Like, it's totally, I get that. I totally get that.
Absolutely.
For sure.
But that drum set's so special. It's so fun to play. And then, like, my other pride and joy is a Buddy Rich 71 Slingerland, the Silver Sparkle one. That's just, it's, I don't know, it's magical. It's studio monster. I haven't had an engineer that's like, this isn't one of the best drum sets that we've tracked with, you know, like, they're so fun. And what's great about reverb in the pandemic right now is, like, everyone is just on, like, kind of a gear sell, you know, everyone's selling gear. So.
I know.
Especially vintage drums, like you can just, I got like a 28 inch bass drum for it. I have a 20 inch kick drum and a 12 inch rack. I already had 13, 16, 16, 18, 22. So now I have like, I could build like this really rad. I want to set them all up at one time, but.
I'm like, saying you're turning into me. Remember last time you were at the house and my oak, the oak that's set up right here. Like
beauty.
I had every size. And I just couldn't, I was like, I couldn't do it anymore. I had to pare it back down, scale it down, and you know, whatever. So I ended up unloading a lot of gear. But yeah, I have four drum sets.
It's the thing. It's tough because there has to be use case for it, right? Like I always feel bad when there's like, when I have a nice kit that I had a purpose for, but now it like kind of just sits around.
I know.
They want to be played, you know? They want to be played. I have a Sonar Phonics 1980 like rustic oak set that I was originally using with Demon. Super special, 9-ply beach, German shells. And I just stopped using it because I like, tonally they were amazing, but like the Vistalites just completely whooped its ass for live volume with a heavier band. And I sold it recently, but like the dude that I sold it to like already had the new version of it from Sonar. It was like SQ2. And he has it in like his little Sonar museum. So it's okay to sell it as long as it goes to the right customer, I think, you know, those attached kits.
Well, obviously, if you've listened this far to Drew, you notice that he knows what he's talking about. You know what I mean? Like you love drums, right?
Absolutely.
And that's part of why I think we instantly became friends. That and obviously a lot of alcohol. But when we first met, we played a show together, right?
Yeah.
I went back in the archives, and it was at a place called Jewish Mother in Norfolk, right?
Virginia Beach.
Virginia Beach. Yep. Yeah, sorry. It's different cities.
It's
the
same. It's 15 minutes.
Right. So, but I remember you were in a band called the Dahus at that point, and you guys were opening up, and then us, and then I believe it was the 1975 Mowgli's and Family of the Year. Is that right?
Yeah, it was a hell of a show. It was
Easter Sunday.
Was Easter Sunday. You know,
that's right.
Ironically, my girlfriend is the program director of that radio station now.
No way.
Well, not a 96X, awesome. But Bob FM, but she's still a program director at Sinclair. And it was, I think it was called a Spring Fling.
It was a spring fling,
and those shows were so cool, dude. And there was another series called Winter Meltdown that they did. But I remember playing with you and immediately like gawking over your drum set. Of course they made us share drums, you know?
So that was that's what I was getting to is I remember I had set up and we had sound check cause they staggered everything backwards. So then you guys came in after, and you literally walked in, and you were like, I don't have to move anything. We play exactly the same. Because back then, you had I had a giant 27-inch Wuhan that I put way up here, like, you know, like John Blackwell, like way up top. And you were like, I'm doing the same thing. You had a Crash of Doom up there, I think, right? Like,
yeah,
something.
It started out as a Crash of Doom, and then it broke, and I got like some really somehow warped 22-inch like 70s A.
Nice. Yeah.
But yeah, that was, it was so, so strange, and the setup was perfect. But I remember you being so cool. When you play with bands, you know, like the 1975, or they're all super cool dudes for the most part, but sometimes there can be some egos, and you're not...
Can I interrupt and tell you a funny story about that day?
Yes, please.
And whatever, I'll tag him. I'll talk to him if I needed to. But
yeah,
I remember walking in that day to the green room, and that it was like literally one room, and they were like... about to skyrocket, and they all knew it, and everybody kind of knew it, and they walked in, and one of them, I don't remember which one it was, I'm just sitting there, which I had every right to be,
yeah,
and they're like, hey man, what are you doing in here? And I go, this is the green room, I'm playing, and I'm gonna be in here. And of course, me, my size, and them, their size, they all kind of went, okay, and just kind of whatever.
Yes, sir.
I was getting dirty looks. It was just like, yeah. They thought it was their green room. I'm like, yo,
Get the
this is
out of here.
The shared green room, you know, whatever.
Yeah, no, especially being the local band, you know, how that reputation is. It's not so often.
And we weren't even the local band.
No, we were. You know, I was in the local band. So to have you and Chris be like such sweet dudes, and you were so welcoming on your kit, and it was just like this awesome correspondence between us originally because of drums. It was just like immediately started talking drums and setups. And you know, you were endorsed with Yamaha at the time and had all this
that
cool
was new at that
LP
point.
Stuff. Yeah, the, what was it? The Cabeza foot shaker.
Did I have it back then? The Fusheki shaker. It's like, I still rock it, dude. I love that thing,
I always want to buy one. It's like that thing that every time I see you, I'm like, I have to get one of those. And then
it changes the game.
I just forget to get one. But it's like, it's the baddest ass left foot tool. You know?
It's amazing. I
for
love
hi-hat
it.
For hi-hat pattern, like a little closed hat on your right hand and the shaker on your left foot.
I actually,
it's got
to
be a dream.
I've gotten it to the point, and I was doing this on our last album. I'll hold the hi-hat down with like the sole of my foot and use my heel, and it still it's hitting. I mean, the hi-hat's moving a little
bit.
Yeah,
you do it sideways.
That's and cool. I was like, I got it. And Chris is like, that's freaking awesome. Like, what I mean, like, anyway.
Yes.
So yeah, that was cool. That's how we met. It actually worked out, and we played several shows together. After that, we haven't played in so long together, and I want to. I haven't played with any of your bands now, and of course, I'm stuck in the same band, of course. But like, we got we're trying, man. I right before this pandemic hit, I was trying to get a show with you and Bennett Wales, and like, it would just never panned out, man.
I know there was a bunch of stuff, a bunch of opportunities. There was that show in Richmond that you tried to get us on too. You tried to get us on the Highly Suspect tour. Which was like super nice. You guys weren't even playing that tour. You played like one show or something, but
we
it's
did.
Always you always look out, man. And it's always it's
well,
very sweet.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the thing is like if there's one thing about this is like the perfect segue, man. It's like you know what you're doing. It's like you host your own podcast. But anyway, it's the same thing. Like when you meet musicians along the way, and again, I was lucky enough that I've toured all over the place. I've met all these drummers.
Yeah,
I immediately talk drums, and you can tell the musician. And then just some guy that plays drums. You know what I mean? That's the biggest thing. And then this brings me to my point where you, in 2020, you won the Veer Award for the Musician's Musician. Is this correct?
That's correct. Yeah. It was...
So explain, what is the Veer Awards?
It's a magazine in Hampton Roads.
Okay.
And they cover just everything art. So they do a Veer Awards every year and... the music awards are like all the bands in town. So you have best music video, best rock album, best R&B record, you know, all of those, tons of categories, tons of musicians and artists in our area. So for me, it was huge. I almost died that year. Well, it was 2019, I guess.
Well, we'll talk about that in a minute, but yes.
Yeah, I ripped out my guts.
Stay tuned, everyone. That's a great story.
Yeah. The owner of Veer just hit me up and was like, dude, like, you've been super impactful, like, with helping other musicians, and, you know, you as a musician are really looked up to. And he's like, I want to give you, like, this musician's musician award. So, I was just blown away, because the guys that had gotten it before me are like, Mike Williams, don't you? He's like drummer for Gib Grohl. Yeah. Just total beast. I mean, he got it before me. And he was one of my mentors. I actually worked at Guitar Center with him, but it was just a huge, huge honor. And I totally am that nerdy musician. I would never assume that there's so many guys like that should have gotten that. When I got it, I almost felt bad. I was just like, damn, dude, like, what about Pal Randolph? What about, you know, all of these other dudes? Scott Travis, you know, fucking Judas Priest is right. Local Hampton Roads. So there's a lot of people that they could have given it to. Honor, but at first I was like, damn, I don't deserve this. But then I was like, oh, I am a nerd and I do try to help musicians out. So,
but it's not only, and it's like you're in several successful bands. I mean, at that point, Four Stage was going up and you were the guy, you were the gear guru there. Like, you were, I mean, yeah. Obviously you didn't own the company, but you were the guy that went out and did it, right? Like, you were,
right.
You were the musician's musician.
Did all the advance work. Yeah. And that was the main thing, is like, with Backline, it's such a great, business to be in as a musician, because you're literally working like hand in hand with some of your favorite drummers. You know, you're looking at their gear, you know, you get to see all of it. You get to, you know, I've gotten to like fulfill the rider for Questlove and Stanton Moore and Adam Deitch and, you know, all of these beasts. And then I get to like hang out with them all day and sit behind the drums and watch them play, you know, like, and then you get paid for it. And for me, it was like, it's the best job besides playing drums. Playing drums for a living is like the only thing that's actually better than like teching, you know?
Yeah, exactly. That's awesome. I mean, I said congratulations. Obviously, it was like a year ago, whatever, but that's great. You're an award-winning drummer. It's amazing. That's
I appreciate
great. Good
it.
For you.
It's right on my shelf. It's a microphone. It's not a drum trophy, but it's okay.
I mean, yeah. Well, what do? You just put like a bass drum and it's like
Yeah, and like making a drum set, you know, out of a trophy is probably pretty fragile. Oh, yeah. So
yeah,
everyone breaks the microphones off anyway.
You had mentioned, obviously, that you almost died that same year. Actually, I looked this up, and again, this all my research is pretty much your Instagram page.
I'm so flattered that you did research on me. Instagram.
I did.
Research.
So it was September 2019. You were in a horrific bike accident.
Yeah.
Is that right?
BMX. It'll be the death.
And you almost died. Like, and you know, people listening or watching or whatever, like, okay, yeah. Like, actually, the funny thing is I almost died, but mine was from a surgery and I didn't stop bleeding. Yours was actually from a crazy, like,
crash
thing that happened. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's pretty gory. If you don't like gore, maybe. let me have it. I want to know.
Here's
a
disclaimer.
You're talking about
parental advisory, everyone. I've always been with drums and BMX have always been like my two things that I use to like ground myself, you know, if I'm stressed out or feeling unhealthy, like mentally, it's always been one of those two things. So BMX has played a large part in my life as well. Yeah. I used to compete when I was younger, and I started getting back into it, not chasing after anybody, you know, I'm not trying to do backflips or go crazy or anything that I used to be able to do, but I just wanted to ride some trails, you know, and with working a lot of these shows, I have tons of downtime on gigs. So from sound check to showtime, I usually have like 5-6 hours to burn. So I just started bringing my bike with me on gig trips, and I was working for Shaka Khan in Richmond and at this like contemporary art museum. And I had a ton of downtime, and my tech with me that day also rode BMX, so we went to these trails in Richmond. Jumped through this section a few times, felt comfortable, got a little cocky, and like tried a trick, just a one-footed X up. You take one foot off, and you turn the bars like this. Ended up overshooting the jump, and I wasn't just not as spry as I used to be. When I went to throw the bike and bail, the bike... The handlebars locked 90 and like just completely went into my stomach. It didn't break the skin, but immediately I was like, oh shit. Like I just Dave Mirra'd my spleen or, you know, I knew something was wrong. He's like, oh, you're just out of breath. But soon enough, like I had my hand down and just felt like a golf ball, tennis ball, softball, oh. until it was like a volleyball. And I'm just like holding my guts really in my skin. And it was super weird. So we had to throw the bikes in the truck. And yeah, he got me to the hospital. He had actually, my tech that went with me broke his hip in half. At the same trails, like,
are you serious?
Yeah, oh, like literally broke his pelvis in half, and like he knew exactly where to take me. He was like, I didn't have like good insurance, so he's like, dude, we're going to VCU Medical. And anyway, long story short, yeah, I almost bled out internally.
Internally,
but they got me in there and like pushed the guts back in. They cut out like, I don't know, like this much of my intestines, and like the weird surgeon was like, dude, look at this, man. Check it out. Like,
but look at this cool little pipe that used to be inside of you. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, it was crazy. Like 7 days, and they put me on fentanyl, which is like more addictive than heroin. Didn't get addicted to it, but they told me I had to poop to leave the hospital. And, opioids like constipate you or whatever. So
yeah.
It was like this never ending challenge of getting out of the hospital. Finally, I was able to poop. Thanks, prune juice.
Yeah, right.
And then, yeah, I got out and I was like on the couch for 6 months, which really sucked not being able to play with the bands and do that shit or work. I couldn't lift 10 pounds. And then got back to work a month later and then bam, like pandemic hit. So like I was just having like this great year. Everything was like going really well. Bands were coming out with new records. Everything was going. And then from that standpoint, it's been like slowly climbing back. But I can play now. I'm back 100% as far as the physicality
goes. That's good.
Goes.
I was going to say, so when you were on the couch doing nothing, like there was no drums. I mean, it was like you, hands, maybe a sticks and pad. But like it was just a lot of Netflix, right? Like it was just like you just chilling.
It got sad fast because I am like definitely one of those people that can't sit still for long periods. I'm sure as you are, as most drummers are, like the ADD is real.
I'm literally shaking right now. My legs are going like, they have to.
You just
like,
playing paradiddles with your feet?
Yeah.
Yeah, same.
So you were there with Chaka Khan in Richmond. Obviously, you were at the hospital in Richmond. What happened that night for the show? Because you and your tech went. So like what happened?
Well, he had to finish the show by himself, which sucked for him because the loadout
with
was...
a broken hip.
Oh no, he broke his hip previously at the same spot. It was like 3 years before my injury. But because of his injury, like, he knew what to do with me, which made it very helpful and like him getting me to the hospital fast.
You guys aren't gonna be riding that trail anytime soon.
No, like everyone, my family and friends are like one of my friends still has my BMX bike and like they're not giving it back. It's been
you get like one of those cruisers and just cruise around downtown.
It's a big part of me. It does suck, but it's not worth like risking. You know, I'll just watch Instagram videos of dudes shredding it now and just play drums because I don't think I can. Like...
Oh, dude, yeah, that's like me with football. Like I love watching football injuries on YouTube because I literally have gone through that. Like,
yeah,
I know when a guy like wrecks his knee because I'm like, oh, I know what that feels like. Oh, oh, look, he's got a concussion. I know what that feels like.
Watch this dude get his ACL destroyed.
I definitely, when I was in college, man, I had to throw javelin, hammer, discus, and shot. And I remember I had messed my elbow up, and I threw the javelin. And you got to throw a javelin like this, right?
Yeah, it has to go straight.
And I threw it like this. And it literally took like this ligament and just went, and my arm hyperextended that way. And I watched it and just went, and just like fell forward and like
did it make a noise?
That's the thing.
Was there any acoustic value to it?
What do you mean, like a big old like thunk or whatever?
Was there any
it was weird. Like I heard it, I like felt it, I actually felt like a weird tear, and then I mean I hit the ground. I was just like, and it just kind of rolled and hit my shoulder, and I was just like, I think my elbow is dislocated, and it was literally just like hanging out that way.
Hard
and
pass.
I just kind of had to pick my arm up and pull. But, you know.
Dude, nope.
Yeah.
Hard pass.
And that's the dumb thing is I was a music major. So I'm doing all this crap, messing up dislocating my shoulders left and right, like doing all this stuff. And I still had to play drums. It was like in an arm sling. Doing like that.
Wave goodbye, baby.
That's right. I did it. You had to do it.
That's it. I same thing with BMX and injuries. Same exact thing. Just play through it, you know? This one I couldn't play through. But, you know, for the most part, it's better now.
Well, hey, you're here. That's the big thing.
It's a big plus. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about a bunch of stuff. Obviously, the handlebar incident, like, which is crazy. Again, you've recovered from that. It's nuts. Be careful BMXing. That's the PSA
yes, kids.
Out there.
Don't. No handlebar hernias.
That's right. Earlier, I guess it was like almost 2 years ago, or it was 2 years ago, you came to Raleigh, and which is, again, we're like, what, 3.5 hours apart? It ain't that far.
Yeah.
You came to Raleigh. You and a girl came to go come see Metallica at PNC. I understand why, but I know, and we even talked about this, like, you know, Lars. I want, if he ever, if I this thing ever takes off and I can get him on here, I'm going to be like, listen.
Sick.
Like, by now, can you just play the right tempo and, like, stay on it? Like,
yeah, it's a shame. You know, you're a stickler like I am, and I'm definitely a whore for click tracks, as you are. And I don't know. I can't stand it, especially when, like, a super high-profile band, like, gets off when I see a drummer do that. It happens, but, like, with him, it's a little too consistent. I mean, it's... He's fun. They're fun to watch. It is Metallica. It's like,
of course.
You know what?
It is,
Who gives a fuck? But like, I'll mention it to my guy and be like, oh my God, he just like missed this like entire intro. Or like, he sped that song up like 10 BPM. My girlfriend's like, can you shut the fuck up, please? I'm trying to enjoy Metallica. So, I have to take you have to take yourself out of that like musician mindset sometimes when you're watching like, you know, a band like
it's
that.
Hard.
And just realize, like, just keep on thinking. Remember Master of Puppets? Like, ride the lightning.
I know. And that's the thing. That's the thing is, like, growing up, like, this was like, we had strived to go here. And then when we like became musicians, it was like, oh no, I don't want to strive to go there. I want to strive to go right. You know what I mean? Like, I always wonder what if it was like, if they took some of that stuff and like remastered it and just put it, threw it up in Pro Tools or Logic and just hit the quantize button and just see what happened. You know what I mean? Like, what would those songs sound? And honestly, I don't know if those songs would sound as cool. You know what I mean? It's like the old vintage drums. You know,
I mean, it wouldn't sound good if you did that to John Bonham. That's for sure.
You know, that's for sure. But he was pretty on most of the time.
Yeah,
most of the time.
I just
he was on something or drunk, but
yeah. And but like, people think that click tracks are restricting, right? Because you have to play that tempo, but it's not necessarily true. Like, you can push and pull pretty drastically. And John Bonham's a good example. You can put, you can get a click track pretty close on a lot of songs, especially like Fool in the Rain and like that, like the shuffle patterns. They're right on, but the only difference is like, he's just hitting those, you know, those snare notes like as late as you could possibly hit with it like almost being out of time. And that shit's awesome. You know, that shit's really, it's intentional.
Right. And that's what gives it what it is, you know. So anyway, I had asked you earlier, I was like, hey, anything you don't want to talk about? Because again, you never know. Like, I don't want to talk about getting stabbed in the guts with my bike.
Oh, yeah,
but,
no.
Again, it's a crazy story. But like you said, I'm an open book, but I definitely want to talk about the relationship between a drummer and a singer-songwriter, which again, we have this in common because you play with Bennett Wales.
Right.
And so it's that kind of same thing with me and my band. We're a duo. So it literally is like kind of in a situation like that, a singer songwriter, quote unquote, and a drummer, you know what I mean? Kind of thing. So
yeah.
What are your thoughts on this? How like moving forward, or people listening? Cause again, drummers, you know, all the drummer jokes and all this kind of stuff. It's just like, it's funny to watch the memes come out and whatever. And then there's Dave Grohl that was like, that's great. You can make all these jokes, but if I wasn't in your band, no one would be here to watch. It's that same. And I'm always just like, we're the cool ones. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Like, So in that aspect of it, when it comes to writing a song, being an actual drummer, quote, drummer songwriter.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, where does that fall in for you, especially? It was like, where does that come in? Where is your input and like in writing these songs with Bennett Wales or with the guys in Demons? Like, where does your input come in?
Well, first off, I have no interest in being a singer-songwriter.
Sure, right.
At all. Which kind of gives me like the utmost respect for them. And I think that kind of personality that you have to be in that position is very vulnerable, you know? Like I kind of loathe that position, and I obviously respect it, but I look at it as being a support system for that person in that situation, and not just mentally or supportively. In music, like musical way, it's I look at myself as like a structure and rhythm guy, and that's like what I do, and then they're usually the singer and melody guy, you know.
Right.
And playing in two-piece bands before, I think that's a really great way to learn, like when you have to fill up all that space as two guys. It's a really good opportunity as a drummer to be a songwriter too.
Yeah.
But like music, especially mainstream music, like you write the lyrics and you write the melody, you're the songwriter, you know. And in a band situation, it's far different. There's rhythms and structures, and then there's melody and lyrics. So it really comes down to the lyricist, the melody writer, and the drummer, you know, in many cases that, you know, those are like the two most important things. No offense, bass or keyboards or whatever, but like they're the glue that comes in later. And that's how I always look at it. Just like trying to build up what they're doing. What can I do with the structure and rhythm to complement their melody and lyrics to its fullest point, you know? That's always the goal. You know, taking charge of like that role, knowing your role, I guess, is really important.
Right. And that's I totally agree with you. And it's that same thing, like you said, being in a two-piece, the Dahus, when we met, was a two-piece band, which is why it worked. But like, when Chris and I, eventually we became a two-piece band, right? That kind of
really
thing. It, like we had other people, but eventually we always wrote together. And now lyrically, the funny thing was, is at one point, especially when this kind of took off, when I'm Dynamite took off, he said straight up, if you want to write a bunch of lyrics, that's cool, then you sing it. And I was like,
I want to sing.
Okay, whatever, you know, whatever. But in that same right, like as you're writing, lyrics are hard. Melodies are obviously rhythm. Melodies, rhythm, all that stuff. And that's the two, we're not a lyric band. You know, people always ask like, what's your song about? And we're like, nothing.
What's your concept?
Absolutely nothing.
Yeah. It's about a party we had 2 days ago.
Yeah. It's about, like if you listen to half the lyrics on the first album, it's ahs, oohs, and ohs. So. So, I mean, it's the funny thing is like it definitely turned into like your role, like you have to almost communicate like, okay, I'm going to make this cool rhythm. And especially now during this pandemic, as we write new stuff, it's like, you know, it's all over the place. Some of that stuff is kind of slow, very melodic.
Sure.
And we're writing, you know, bangers like we used to, which is kind of cool. And it's fun. And
yeah,
it's
more
like,
high energy stuff.
You know, I'm not literally just going do-da-do-da or, you know, hey, a boom chuck just like this. You know what I mean? I'm not doing that. I'm,
boots,
you know,
and cats,
doing
boots
more.
And cats and boots.
Yeah. Sixteenths and all that, of course, but it's like in my mind, it's like if you set that rhythm, the song should be able to be sung to that rhythm, and everyone will know it. It won't even matter what the other candy is like, and that's the thing. You listen to old Prince stuff; there's no bass on that. There literally is no bass on some of that Prince stuff.
No, because it was all groove. It was 100% groove.
Yeah,
it's funny. Yep. The podcast we did tonight on Death by Music was on Prince, which is
really
funny that you brought him up. Yeah. Super rad.
He's not dead though.
He's definitely dead, unfortunately.
He's not dead. I'm telling you, he's not dead.
He's not dead? You think it's like some conspiracy?
I think him and Elvis are just flying around in like a spaceship, just kind of hanging out.
Hanging out with their rock doctors.
Yeah.
Taking
exactly.
all the prescription pills.
Just popping all the pills they can just to whatever, to feel something.
Playing all the funk.
Did you ever hear that Prince actually was a phenomenal drummer?
Oh yeah. He played 29 different instruments.
Yeah,
and he was awesome at all of them. The only guy that could compete with him is like maybe Stevie Wonder, as far as just being able to play everything like that virtuosically. He was just absolute monster. It's unreal. You know the reason why he was such a good musician too is because he wanted to get the fuck out of Minneapolis.
Right.
That was the only reason. He's like, dude, yeah, I got to get out of this town. This shit sucks. I'm going to be stuck here forever, living in low income, blah, blah, blah. I got to be sick at everything. And he just started, he was like, oh, you can't play that? I'll play that. You can't play that? I'll play that. I'll play it better than you. Give me that drum set. Give me that bass. Whatever it was.
I wish I could have that. Everybody was always like, can you play guitar? And I'm like, no. I tried.
I can play drums on it. I can tap on it, you know. Same thing. Yeah. See, there's no want in that. There's no want for that. Like, I like to work with guitar players. I don't want to know. Like, I don't care enough.
Dude, I had to do all that theory crap. And again, Chris and I can talk. And obviously with the vocals and harmonies and stuff, we talk about it and we figure it all out. But it's like, man, being a drummer, having to know, like, quote unquote, the drum theory rudiments and all this other stuff. And then on top of that, having like my education be like all about scales and theory. And it's just like, it's
almost two different things. I love that conversation of just how like singer songwriters try to communicate with drummers is always like historically like really funny when they don't know like the terminologies or the count or the time signature. It's really, really funny how that works. It's like,
Chris and I, we count differently. Mm-hmm. I love counting. I count the eighth notes. Like, if my clicks are always doubled, like, I want to hear this.
Yeah. He wants consistent. To
hear, you know, like whatever. And I'm like, okay. Like,
right.
So he'll be like, oh, it's just one measure. But then in one measure to him is two measures to me. It's like, we count completely different.
Right.
We're running a
Benny
song
does
now,
the same shit
literally
to me
in 6/4, but I'm playing 4/4 and then a measure of like all the way and then a measure of 2/4 because of what the melody does.
Sure.
Like, the drums sound better that way.
Absolutely.
And he's like, it does sound, but it's so cool because then everybody realizes we're in 6/4 at the end of it. It's like, it is kind of cool, but it's still catchy that way.
Yeah, and then you have the over the bar vibe, right? On the 3/4 or whatever.
Yeah.
That's cool shit.
Yeah. So I'm excited. I mean, we'll see what happens. You know, again, we're working hardly working, but
I can't wait. I can't wait to hear the new stuff for sure.
The funny thing is we're trying to find somebody here, somebody local. Like, you know, we've recorded in Texas, our label's in Texas, all this stuff, but like, we want somebody in North Carolina where we are, or close enough, you know what I mean? Like, whatever. And just like, go to a studio and have somebody to work with to bounce ideas off of. Because again, having a duo sounds awesome, but there's not, it's a constant compromise. And then something comes out. There's not a deciding vote.
The production weight is so much heavier. You know,
yeah.
Also, with like filling it up, and even if that's not like adding instrument decisions, it's like, you know, adding percussion or doing crazy vocal harmonies, which you guys annihilate. That's always been one of like the fucking magical. I wish I could sing like you or how you do the harmonies.
It's
such a huge strength. It's like
I just squeeze it out. That's all I do is squeeze
it
out.
Just squeeze it out. Just tighten it up and squeeze it out.
The funny thing, I did that for years, and then my vocal teacher's like, no, do not do that anymore. You won't be able to speak in like 10 years.
Yeah.
It's all about the space. Anyway, my dream, like no joke, is to just tour with some band, some stadium band, and I'm just their percussionist, and I do like the doo-wop background vocals. That to me,
a little bit of cabeza,
just like
and just
have a bunch of LP raw cans and a bunch of congas and bongos and like hit like two or three of them, but like somebody sets this stuff up for me every night, and all I do is sit there and shake that tambourine, you know, like that'd be amazing.
You need to get in the jam band market. You missed your calling.
I know, but then I'd actually have to like do, because it changes all the time.
That's the band. It's gonna be like it'll be like Slightly Stupid or Pigeons Playing Ping Pong. Those guys all get to do that.
It's true.
Night.
Oh man,
giant percussion rigs, dude. So much fun.
I love it. You can't see it back here. I did get some new congas right before the pandemic. So I have the new Uptown Ash LPs.
You got all three of them?
I got all three of them and the bongos. I love gear. It doesn't matter what it is. Obviously, I have my things, but like, I love gear. It doesn't matter. I was always a gear whore. Like, love talking about it. That's why I was, you know, again, full circle, beauty to work at Guitar Center. See all the new crap that was coming out. Like, do whatever.
Yeah.
But
now you just merchandise your basement, you know.
Basically, yeah. But then it's
how many times do you set up like your drum set and just look at it.
I mean, the funny thing is for a long time, every week I was trying to set up a new like version of a drum set, cymbals, whatever, and just play. So I played, we would rehearse, we do all whatever, and I'd tear it all down on Sunday night and I'd put up a new one. Like, and again, like it doesn't even matter. Like it could be the Oaks, it could be the what, like could it doesn't. I, there was a one time I think I had like an Oak bass drum, my raw can as a floor tom, and like two rack toms from whatever other drum set I had laying around. Like it was just kind of like, why not? It's just gonna be, it's gonna be weird. I wish.
It's great experimentation.
Yeah, well, and in my mind, it almost makes you better because like you can just focus on where you what you got to hit. You know your part. But what are you going to hit? What's going to make it cooler? And now I'm getting into like all the cymbal stacks. Everyone's getting into the cymbal stacks. So I was like, I should get a cymbal stack. So I
got to have them.
You have one?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Just cracked Wuhans. And I just use cracked cymbals. I don't use anything in particular.
See, that's the thing. As soon as I crack it, I also got into like boring out. Like if I cracked something, I take my little router gun and just get it out there and it changes the sound completely. But
yeah, you just leave it. Let it sizzle. Kind of fun. Let it sizzle.
No, but as soon as I always had the experience, as soon as you crack a cymbal, it's like four or five hits later, there's no point. There's no point of keeping it. I did crack that 27 inch Wuhan after 10 and a half years or something like that.
Damn.
I never had, and that was, I remember exactly where we were. I like, again, it was enormous, right? It was like a giant spaceship and it sounded amazing, especially when we laid into it. Never put it in a case. Just threw it in the back of the either the van or the trailer, just on top of everything, whatever. Yeah. And dude, it like I was in Kansas City and I was hitting it and I was just like, man, it's just not giving me the power. And I'm just laying into it, whatever. And after the show, I look and there was just, I mean, in the middle of it, it wasn't even like a hairline crack. It was just like a like stick went through it. It was just like a thin spot that like eventually just wore out. The nice thing
it
is
it just gave up completely on you.
Yeah, yeah. I spray painted it. I spray painted IAD on it and then sold it at our merch area for almost what I bought it for.
Nice. See, there you go.
I was like, oh, that's cool.
Super resourceful.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know who has it. I kind of wish I kept it though, but yeah, it is what it is.
Yeah, you should find it. It's a wall trophy. At the same time, it's like whatever.
It was a big wall trophy.
It was a special girl. That thing, it demanded attention on stage.
It did.
Just the visual of it was fucking hilarious.
Well, the best part, I used to hit it only for big endings, and then one of our songs I would hit it, like a song called Miss Jones, I would go crazy on it. But like, there would be times, especially in small clubs, people would be like, just doing this, you know, like, really like wincing up, like, I can't hear anything but this stupid china. And as soon as I cut it off, it just died, and everyone was like, oh, that was cool, you know, kind of thing. But I can get that now, man. I got a 24, it does the same thing, you know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I worked, funny story about those giant, I think it was a 30-inch china. How, yours was 28?
27, yeah.
Yeah. I worked for Mickey Hart once, which is one of the Grateful Dead drummers.
Oh, yeah.
And they did, like, this giant, all the old Grateful Dead. So it was, like, Bill Kreutzmann, like, all the old Grateful Dead members did a big thing at Locke in this festival near Arrington in Virginia, mm-hmm. like, in the mountains. Mm-hmm. And his poor tech, dude, like, Mickey Hart decided he wanted to do all this weird stuff. He had like this electronic stage where he was like building his setup while he's like supposed to perform. He's rehearsing with this band. He didn't rehearse anything. He like, it was just a really weird scenario, but he had this 30-inch china and it's just, they're all playing together. They're all shredding and Mickey Hart decides he wants to like just lay into this thing with a bass drum mallet. And it's on like a 9,000 stand. Right. You know, like it was high, but it was boomed out, solid, legs spread as far as you could. Yeah. And he just starts beating the shit out of it. And the shit, it just keeps falling over. Like it keeps going. His tech comes up, dude. And I just remember watching this poor tech, his drum tech, who was just like, God, he was so abused. But no earplugs, just like holding the two legs on this 9,000 stand while Mickey Hart just like annihilates this china.
Yeah.
And it was a sad moment. I was just like, dude, I'm sorry.
Our guy wanted to do it. I used to make him like hold this because it fell over. It actually fell over and hit a lady in the head one time. Like that, my big china.
Yeah, see?
So I told him straight up, I'm like, you need to either hold it or sandbag it. We used to gaff tape it down to stages if I was up. Like,
yeah.
It happens, you know?
And you got on top of it too, you know?
Oh, yeah. It's part of the show. I mean, come on.
It is. It's great. It's absolutely great.
Not only do you do all these things, award-winning drummer, Metallica hater. Oh, we never even talked about you showing up at my house because I saved you from a human trafficking thing.
We got caught off guard by the Lars combo.
We did, and that led to gear. It always leads to gear, which is fine.
Son of a bitch.
Well, really quick. Actually, I remember this, like, obviously, we don't see each other all the time, so when we do see each other, I remember, but it was my birthday. It was literally my birthday.
It was your birthday.
It was.
I bought like a 36-pack.
Yeah, you guys showed up. Came Metallica, you got a Airbnb, and I think you just reached out. You were just like, hey, man, we're in Raleigh, blah, blah, blah. And I was just like, I even offered. I said, you need a place to stay. Oh, I got an Airbnb. And no joke, I think you guys went there before the show, right? And it just got real weird, didn't it?
It was super strange. It was in this place near the stadium, near PNC.
Yeah.
And it was like an apartment complex. And we got there. My girlfriend booked it. And like, there's this guy in the living room, and he's like, all of a sudden, he's talking to me, and he's trying to like separate me from her in kind of a weird way.
That's
like, I'd
weird.
Be in the kitchen. Yeah. We were looking the key for our room. It was like a shared unit with like three different bedrooms, and the key for our room was missing. So we're trying to get a hold of the owner. He wasn't answering. We're like looking for this key, and the whole time while I'm looking for this key, this dude is trying to like kind of seclude me in the kitchen or like kind of corner me and talk to me about all these business opportunities. He was like talking about selling newspapers and selling like t-shirts and all kinds of just weird, strange business ideas. It didn't make any sense. It was super, super shady. So we're like, all right, you know what? We're going to go get some margaritas. This shit's stressful. This guy's weird as fuck. The owner still didn't get back to us. Also, all the doors looked like they've been kicked in. So, like, you know, you can lock a door and just, like, push it open. Every single door did that. And it was a shared situation.
It's crazy.
You know, super shady. I was immediately like, we're not staying there. Like, I'll find us another Airbnb. But, like, my buddy Chris lives here. You can call him up and see what he can do. And, like, sure enough, like, you bailed us out. And then we researched it after the fact. And, like, that area, strangely enough, is like a hotspot for human trafficking. Like there's
like
been
just where that apartment was.
That there's like I don't know, like a 1 or 2 mile area right there where like there had been cases where girls have been abducted and
dude,
all kinds of fucked up shit. So
it's
you saved
it's
us.
Really strange. Like growing up just outside of Detroit, nobody ever talked about it, but Canada was obviously right there, so that was kind of a thing. But dude, when we moved down here to Raleigh. Every day. I mean, because 95 is like Miami to New York and back, like
straight
it's
shot.
Crazy how much human trafficking there is. So it's, I mean, I'm from the stories, the story has never changed and it doesn't get weirder. It's just that. And that's what it is. I'm taking that. And I'm going to say I'm a true friend because I saved you from you and your girl from human trafficking. They were going to take you guys somewhere and sell you. And I appreciate you coming and staying with me in safety.
Full credit, dude. You get full credit. Everyone was happy. I got to see you. I got to see Metallica. You know, it was a great time, and I appreciate you.
Anytime. So what I was leading to before all that, before I realized we didn't even talk about that, was if people go to your Instagram, again, which is at Drew Orton, right? That's it? No numbers, no nothing, just at Drew Orton.
That's it.
They will notice that you are a semi-famous underwear model. That's my last. That is my last point. As people go and look and explore this, I'm gonna drop this and correct me if I'm all wrong. But Demons is at Demons Band, yeah. And I'm assuming is it demonsband.com is the website, right?
Demons Band USA.
USA.
We had a tiff with the Swedish Demons.
No,
there is another Demons out there.
You should just reach out and be like, listen, let's do a Demons tour, and we'll just. The two demons go together.
Demons Sweden, Demons USA. Yeah.
Yes.
That's why we changed the demons.
There's always a... I'm sure there's a Swedish I Am Dynamite floating around out there.
For sure. Yeah, it's probably a black... There's probably a black metal I Am Dynamite in Sweden.
And then Bennett Wales and the Relief Instagram is at the Relief. Yeah? That's it.
That's it. Yep.
What's the website there? Is it BennettWalesandTheRelief.com or TheRelief.com?
Shit, I wasn't prepared for this. Hold on.
Oh, boy. Come on. You don't even know your website.
I should know. I should know all the plugs.
And all you got to do is make that sweet beat. That's all you got to do.
That's all I do. I stay away from... I know that you work pretty hard in the PR department.
But I'm extrovert. I like talking to people and doing all this crap, so, you know.
Dude, it's exhausting. Like, I've been in that place in bands before, and that's a big toll to take on top of everything else. The business aspects are very exhausting.
I don't know. I'm stingy, man. If I don't have to pay you to do something, I will not pay you to do it. But he's just like,
you got
to
get the deal.
Yeah, of course we'll pay you to do it. I'm like, no. I want to find the cheapest crew. I want this. I want this. I'm a stickler. I'm a sucker for a good deal, and I'm a stickler with money. So
it's opportunity. It's opportunist. You know, you got to do it.
That's right. Anyway, well, yeah, we got all that stuff in. Dude, it was good to see you. Thank you for being, and I said this before, I don't think it was recording yet, but literally my first Skype guest. Like, this is, and I'm cheap. Again, I'm cheap. I don't want to pay for Zoom. So, you know, we went over an hour here. So
I figured it out.
Yeah.
I figured it out.
It's free. So Skype's free. Anyway.
It's fun to see your face. I recorded it all on Pro Tools, so I'll drop it to you.
Yeah, drop it to me, and I'll take out all my. I did notice this. When you're doing a podcast, you notice like how many times you say like or do whatever. It's like,
it sucks. It sucks. You realize a lot about the way you talk, for sure.
It's like, yeah. I was like, do I really sound? I asked my wife. I'm like, do I sound that dumb when I speak? And she was like, I don't know how to answer this.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, honey. Yes, you do.
Yeah, you do. Yeah.
It is weird. It's the same reason why I'm not a singer. I don't want to hear my voice. I'd rather hear like me play drums. Which playing drums, it's the same way. You know?
Yeah.
Like it's your like voice. You can be as pessimistic as you want.
In a studio setting or doing whatever, you like miss a snare hit or you accidentally did a rim shot or just something's a little weak and you're just like, you're like dejected, like, oh no, I'm the worst drummer ever. Like
it's an electric, like it's an electric line up your spine, and you're just like, oh god! Like it makes you twitch a little bit.
Did you ever watch the Foo Fighters documentary? And Taylor Hawkins was like, his process is the first three takes, he is the worst drummer on the planet, and then something clicks in, and then like three takes after that, he's good to go.
Get comfy, like, warm up, especially in the studio. You know that can be really nerve wracking. When you're playing in front of maybe a new engineer, just being under the microscope that heavy and everyone's listening to you when you're always used to everyone listening to you, you know, playing live. It's nerve wracking. It takes a lot of time.
Are you one of those drummers that it's gotta be perfect? You don't want, you know, you don't want those little nudges or the, you know, you want the imperfections and stuff like just in there? Or are you like, that's a great chorus. Fly it. That's this. Fly it all over the place and chop it up and do whatever.
I'm not anti-edit. How I'll normally do it is I'll look at the song and then I'll try to do it in three takes.
Yeah.
The first take being like dumb simple, like all the important stuff, super simple. Second take, usually do a little bit more embellishment, usually go a little bit more over top of the fills. And then the third take, I'll just free for all it, you know, just fucking Jackson Pollock that shit.
Nice.
And then out of those three takes, generally, like I have really good shit from one thing or the other. Sometimes the creative take is like complete trash, you know, or sometimes the simplest thing you played was the best. But a lot of times it's like a collage of all those. So I like to do that and edit it. I mean, ideally I like to really think out everything that I'm playing beforehand and then go try to execute it with three takes. But in the studio setting, like especially studio sessions, that three take rule is like been really, really helpful for me.
Yeah. It all depends. It all depends on how you feel that day. Sometimes you're not getting it. You're just like, yeah, man, hit that quantize button, go for it and figure it all out.
Or like with session stuff, you have to trick yourself into liking some of it, you know, where it's like, oh, I got to play on a pop country record this afternoon. I don't know how many songs, like nine country pop country songs. And you're just like,
yeah,
well, I don't really listen to it, but I'm going to listen to it on the way to the studio and I'm going to try to get my head in there and
you're right.
I'm going to be authentic. I'm going to be authentic, damn it. Yeah.
Oh, well. All right, buddy. It was great to see you. And
so good to see you.
Yeah, man. Thanks for being on my podcast. I appreciate it.
So stoked that you have a podcast. Honored to be here.
Yeah, man.
Miss you. Can't wait to see you soon.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to the Boom Chuck podcast. Here is a snippet of a song from the band Demons that Drew is in. He picked this for you guys to listen to. So again, here's Demons and Drew Orton on drums. Thank you for listening to the Boom Chuck podcast.